Well, good morning. This is Jeff Blankfort welcoming you to the September 9th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to you, our listeners. On my last program, I overlooked an important anniversary happening that day, as did most of the media. Wednesday, August 26th, marked 1 year since the end of Israel's most recent assault on the people of Gaza, whose lives and fortunes it has controlled since taking over the coastal strip of Palestine from Egypt in the 1967 war. The Israelis labeled a 51-day operation Protective Edge, and before it was over, more than 2,100 Palestinians would be killed, most of them women and children, and more than 11,000 wounded. By contrast, 73 Israelis died, 67 of whom were soldiers. The remaining six included one child. It was not a war, but a massacre carried out by the world's fifth or sixth most powerful military, armed and supported to the teeth by the United States against a largely defenseless population that had no place to hide. It was the fourth time since 2006 that Israel had conducted what might be called a deadly military exercise against the people of Gaza, which some Israeli military officials had come to describe as, quote, mowing the grass, end quote. As I saw for myself during Israel's occupation of Lebanon in 1983 and on past visits to the West Bank and Gaza, there is no shortage of sadists in the Israel Defense Forces. Last year's assault was the third time in the first 6 years of Barack Obama's presidency that Israel has mowed the grass of Gaza, but this episode was the most deadly and destructive yet. Apart from the dead and the wounded, the physical destruction was immense, with 18,000 homes being either completely or partially destroyed, while whole sections of villages were leveled and nearly 500,000 displaced. Other than compensating the UN for destruction of its buildings in Gaza, Israel has not been required to pay a single shekel for reparations or repairs. Since Israel controls the flow of construction materials into the besieged strip, there is not much difference in how it looks today than it did on the last day of the assault. During Israel's bombardment, the hospitals were under tremendous pressure to treat the wounded under the most difficult of conditions. One of the doctors attempting to do so, even as Israel's made-in-the-USA bombs were falling all around them, was the Norwegian physician Mads Gilbert, who has long been devoted to the people of Gaza, people of Palestine, and their efforts to survive under Israel's siege. Dr. Gilbert has just published a powerful book about his experiences working in Gaza's Al-Shifa Hospital during the 15-day period in last year's bloody summer. He is called The Night in Gaza, and at 20 minutes past the hour, I'll be speaking to him about it at his home in Norway. A moment ago, I mentioned that the weapons employed by the Israelis in Gaza were made in America. It is what separates Israel's war on its 1.8 million residents from the carnage occurring in Syria, Iraq, and Yemen, and other parts throughout the world. But it's not just the bomb. With the exception of the Merkava tanks, which it manufactures, and its drones, virtually every lethal weapon used by the Israeli military against Palestinians in Gaza, the West Bank, or Lebanon is manufactured in the United States and presented to the Israelis as a gift of the White House, the Pentagon, and the Israeli-occupied U.S. Congress. It is the U.S. taxpayers who foot the bill, of course, but are kept in the dark about the details by a media that has gotten used to censoring what Israel's powerful friends in America do not want to see published. I refer to the M16 assault rifles and the ammunition they use, the Apache helicopters and the Hellfire missiles that make them so deadly, and to the F-16 fighter jets and the bombs and rockets beneath their wings, against which the Palestinians have, at best, a few RPGs or rocket-propelled grenades. On top of that, the U.S. maintains a weapons storage depot in Israel that you may have not heard about. It was placed there for use by American forces in the region by George Bush Sr. in the run-up to the first U.S.-Iraq war. As a sop for staying out of that war and jeopardizing the president's Arab coalition, provisions were made for Israel to make use of those weapons as needed, again at no cost, even though there's no record that they replace what they use, which is supposed to be part of the agreement. Moreover, this past May, as I reported on Takes in the World at the time, and you heard nowhere else, President Obama authorized the Pentagon to provide Israel with an additional $1.9 billion in U.S. weaponry on top of the $3.1 billion it had already received, making it cool $5 billion. The U.S. government, it should be noted, classified these billion-dollar gifts to Israel as quote-unquote sales, another sign of the duplicity and immorality that shrouds the relations between the two countries. Washington gives Israel its $3.1 billion appropriation in cash, and Israel is required to spend three-quarters of it in the U.S. purchasing American-made weaponry. News of the additional $1.9 billion was widely reported in the Israeli press, but not in any domestic media outside of some Jewish community weeklies, which portrayed it as an effort to get Netanyahu to tone down his opposition to the Iran nuclear deal. If that was the case, it obviously didn't work. Since the U.S. mainstream media still has yet to carry the story for reasons I will let you speculate, I'll repeat what the Times of Israel reported on May 20th. Quote, Israel will receive a supply of precision-guided munitions consisting of 750 bunker buster bombs, 3,000 Hellfire missiles, 250 medium-range air-to-air missiles, and 4,100 glide bombs in a deal worth $1.9 billion. In addition, the package includes 14,500 missile guidance systems known as tail kits for Joint Direction Action Munitions, which convert unguided bombs into GPS-guided missiles. To be sure, those bunker busters are not sufficient to penetrate Iran's deepest nuclear facilities, but they would cause considerable damage in either Gaza or Lebanon. This is something to think about when you hear or read reports that the Obama administration has defeated the Israel lobby, most notably AIPAC, over its opposition to the Iran nuclear deal. It is AIPAC that drew up the sanctions that have long been in place against Iran, and we may presume that it is AIPAC that is drawing up new ones that Israel's agents in the Senate are planning to introduce and get passed however Congress votes on the agreement with Iran. According to the National Iranian American Council, the opposition is already hard at work on its Plan B. Senator Ben Cardin of Maryland, the ranking Democrat on the Foreign Relations Committee, who has come out against the deal, is now working with other Democrats, including some of the 41 who are reluctantly supporting it, to put together new legislation to undermine the agreement's implementation. Cardin and New Jersey's Robert Menendez, the first Senate Democrat to publicly oppose the agreement, are both on the advisory board of the Israel Project, a hardline pro-Israel organization that propagandizes the American media. That more than two dozen members of Congress serve on the advisory board of the Israel Project should warrant an investigation by the Department of Justice's Foreign Agents Registry Department. But like everything else, when it comes to Israel, ordinary standards do not apply. In any case, opponents of the deal show no signs of giving up. AIPAC alone has already spent $40 million to try to kill it, and it's clear that it's going to continue along that path with the aim of dismantling the deal after President Obama leaves office. Today in Washington, Republican presidential candidate Ted Cruz will be holding a rally against the Iran nuclear deal with rival Donald Trump as the guest star. That's the tip of the iceberg of campaigning and fundraising to thwart the deal by nonprofits funded partly by casino billionaire Sheldon Adelson, other right-wing groups, and fellow GOP candidates such as Marco Rubio, according to the Guardian of London. Congress technically has until September 17th to approve or disapprove the deal. That it will be disapproved is a certainty, but not by a big enough margin to overcome President Obama's promised veto. Another issue, however, may get in the way of the vote even happening. Bill Kristol, co-founder of the Project for New American Century, the Israel front group that lobbied for the war in Iraq, and who now, among other things, is the head of the Emergency Committee for Israel, is charging that the Obama administration has not lived up to the terms of its agreement with Congress. Kristol asserts that Obama has broken his promise to provide Congress with all the non-public side agreements made with Iran, including a private one between Iran and the International Atomic Energy Agency governing its inspections. Since he hasn't, writes Kristol, not only should Congress not vote on the agreement in the next week or so, he should take the president to court if he is not willing to turn the text of the side agreements over to the deal's critics. That very well may happen, so stay tuned. From another corner of Washington's pro-Israel network, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, or JINSA, the 41-year-old neocon operation that Colin Powell blamed for the Iraq War, Two former generals have been selected to head JINSA, calls the Iran Strategic Council. Writing a critique of the Iran deal yesterday, General retired James Conway, former commandant of the Marine Corps, General retired Charles Wald, former deputy commander of the United States European Command, note that, quote, "The president has made clear that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, that's the official name of the agreement, does not preclude the need for robust military capabilities." And they quote Obama, quote, "If 15 or 20 years from now," they write, quoting the president, "Iran tries to build a bomb, this deal ensures the United States will have, if necessary, military options." And yet, our generals attest, even as the agreement boosts Iran's ability to meddle in the region and strains longstanding alliances, sequestration is already diminishing the U.S. military's ability to project power in the Middle East. They go on to say, quote, "The U.S. military will still rise to face any future challenge, but it will do so with less manpower, fewer capabilities, more antiquated platforms, and a lower level of readiness than it has now or has had in a very long time. For all these reasons," they ominously conclude, "the United States is in far better position to prevent a nuclear Iran today, even by military means, if necessary, than when the JCPOA sunsets. Protecting our national interest and our allies will require putting in place a strategy to begin mitigating the deal's downsides now," end quote. Generals Conway and Wald, I've reread those last two paragraphs several times, and it seems apparent to me these two former generals are calling for the U.S. to launch a war against Iran now, and given the organization sponsoring them, JINSA, it would be on Israel's behalf. This morning, I found out, the two former generals presented their arguments and testimony before the House Foreign Relations Committee. And while on the subject of nuclear weapons in Israel, the assertion made by Grant Smith, director of IRMEP, Institute for Research, Middle East Policy, and a frequent guest on Takes on the World, that during the administration of Lyndon Johnson, an excessive amount of enriched uranium was diverted to Israel by NUMEC, a Pennsylvania-based government contractor, has been confirmed by documents just released by the CIA following a suit brought against the agency by Smith. What is not clear from the highly redacted documents is what role the CIA had played. Many of the 130 file memos record CIA briefings in the late 1970s to members of Congress inquiring whether diversion was a covert CIA operation. Arizona Democrat Mars Udall asked bluntly on August 23, 1977, he asked, quote, "Is it possible that President Johnson, who was known to be a friend of Israel, could have encouraged the flow of nuclear materials to the Israelis?" Associate Director for Operations Theodore Shackley and Deputy Director for Science and Technology Carl Duckett for the CIA denied the CIA played any role. They noted it was CIA Director Richard Helms who first alerted the Justice Department requesting in 1968 that the FBI conduct a discreet intelligence investigation into NUMEX President Shapiro's activities. The FBI investigation documented Shapiro's many meetings with Avraham Hermoni, director of Israel's nuclear weapons program, and Shapiro's invitation to top covert operative Rafi Atan, who later ran the Israeli spy Jonathan Pollard, to visit NUMEC facilities in 1968. The now-defunct Atomic Energy Commission successfully organized the transfer of NUMEC's ownership to another contractor. In 1981, special agents finally interviewed a former NUMEC employee who had witnessed the diversion, how Zalman Shapiro and other NUMEC officials stuffed highly enriched uranium canisters into irradiators that were rushed to Israel. Lacking that missing piece of the puzzle, the FBI investigation went dormant as the statute of limitations for Atomic Energy Act violations expired. Today, the raised NUMEC facility near Apollo, Pennsylvania, is a Superfund site. Estimated cost to carry out the toxic waste cleanup over the next decade is between $350 and $500 million, according to U.S. Army Corps of Engineer estimate. CIA Station Chief John Hayden, who's in Tel Aviv, whose findings are redacted from the new release, had publicly characterized NUMEC as, quote, "an Israeli operation from the beginning," end quote. Grant Smith and the Institute for Research Middle East Policy are planning further court actions to obtain full release of CIA operation files that would allow Apollo residents to sue the Israeli government directly for cleanup costs and massive health-related damages caused by the Israeli smuggling front, or have the funds deducted from Israel's annual $3.5 billion package of foreign aid. I was going to go on to tell you, for years, the U.S. government has been in denial about Israel's possession of nuclear weapons, but now the State Department has released documents that show that they have known about it and discussed Israel's possession of these weapons going back to 1969, but they have left the discussion out of the public arena, and they believed at the time that even if Israel would sign a nonproliferation agreement, they wouldn't live up to it.